Hate to break up fellowship, but not really, because there's a really good announcement I want to make. So, just a few moments ago, I got a text from our director of operations, Cody McCoy, that he baptized his daughter.
Wonderful.
I assume in the pool downstairs. So that was great. I don't know if it got announced, but we also had two other baptisms this week for people in the community that we study with, and we're handing them off to the local congregations. So that's very exciting. And I know there's a lot of the hotel and event center staff that people have been inviting and talking to, and everybody has been so, I'm sure, so kind to them. And it's just, you know, when you bring a whole bunch of Christians together, really good things happen. Mm-hmm. So I'm excited about that. How many of y'all is it's your first time at PTP? Wow. All right. Well, welcome, and we're excited that you're here. I hope you've enjoyed it. It's winding down now, and it's not a ghost town, so I like that. I'm going to start with part two of How We Got the Bible. And today we're going to talk about transmission. We're going to start with Hebrews 1 and talk about how long ago, at many times and in many ways, God spoke to our fathers by the prophets, but in these last days he's spoken to us by his Son, whom he appointed heir of all things, from whom also he created the world. And we think about some of the ways that God has talked to us through the ages, some of them on the screen, and you can skip ahead to some of that, you can jot them down, take pictures, whatever you like. But we think about the ways that God has talked to us, and we talked a little bit about it in the first class, if you were in that. The idea that if God had a message that's so important that it has to get to everybody, to every person, not just every person today, but every person 2,000 years from now, how would he do that? And there's very many ways that he has done some of that. But in these last days, he's done it through his Son and through the Word, and he wrote it down. He starts, we look at Genesis, he walks and talks with Adam. He used angels as messengers, the casting of lots in order to determine God's will. This was used often in the temple to select priests for specific duties and for other decisions as well. The voice of conscience, that's Romans 2:15. He uses that to talk to us, not speak to us in a whisper in our ear, but just our conscience that he uses unless we have cauterized it, unless we have seared our conscience off and we can no longer be reached, if we refuse to combat sin in our life, if we stop fighting, if we stop walking in the light. Our conscience will work for us in that way. Through creation, he speaks through his creation. We can look about the universe and marvel at everything from the greatest, largest things in the universe to the smallest atoms and how things work that are beyond even our comprehension. He speaks with his voice in 1 Samuel 3 and in Matthew 3:17, where he spoke at Jesus' baptism. He spoke through direct miracles in the Old and New Testaments. And he no longer speaks through miracles today. And through his prophets. Again, he no longer speaks through his prophets today, modern day prophets, but the prophets are written down, and we have those prophecies that we can look to and show their fulfillment, many of them in Christ, over 400 of them. And so God has used all of these different ways to speak to us. And today he speaks to us through the Word and through language. And we look at the three primary languages that he has used throughout the centuries. And we look at Hebrew. Hebrew, a specific language to a specific people, his chosen people, the Jews, the Hebrews. And it was originally written, the Bible, in three different languages, Hebrews, Greek, and a little bit of Aramaic. Hebrew is a specific language written to God's people, communicated in that language, part of the Semitic family, as is Aramaic, and it's a specific language for that specific people. That's important to keep in mind because God's message at that time was for the Jews, his chosen people. We then see in the New Testament a dramatic shift into Greek being the primary language that's used. And that's an Indo-European language, the chosen language of the New Testament, specifically Koine Greek or common Greek of the time. It was essentially the international language, we call the lingua franca now, which is currently English in the world. If you're going to an international airport, for instance, they have to speak English. The pilots do, and the air traffic controllers do. Things of that nature, that's the current lingua franca. It's been English, thanks to the, not America, but the English empire. The sun never set on it. It was French at one time, probably thanks to our friend Napoleon there. And it was Latin for a while, and at this time, the first century, it was Koine Greek. And that is a universal language at that time. It was the trade and commerce. That was kind of what people expected you to be able to speak in if you were dealing anywhere in the Mediterranean. So they might have a different language as their main language, but Koine Greek would be something that they could converse in and do business in. And then Jesus spoke Aramaic, and that was the day-to-day language of that area in Israel. It's evidence found in Mark 5:41, Mark 7:34, Mark 15:34. Whenever there's this direct quote of Jesus, short quotes are often put in Aramaic. And so we see those three languages being predominantly used. It was also used a little bit in the Old Testament. Jesus also clearly spoke and read Hebrew. He does that in Luke 4:17 and 18, and he speaks in Hebrew to Saul in Acts 26. I forgot to take out the transitions, I'm sorry. I'm not a fan of transitions anymore. Anyway, we're gonna talk a little bit about transmission. How did the message get down to us in its current form? And when you talk about this, critics often criticize the Bible. They say you don't have any of the original manuscripts. You don't have any autographs, and that's very true. We immediately can see that. We don't have anything signed by Paul. We don't have anything signed by Moses or Isaiah. That's absolutely true. We don't claim to. But their claim that this is like the game of telephone. Now, there's some younger people in here. I don't know if you still play telephone. When I was a kid, you would start over here and you would say peas, but you can only say it once. You have to whisper it in their ear. And usually it was more than just one word. It's like a little phrase that you would say. And it'd be peas, the next person would say bees, knees, cheese, and comes out fleas, and you all laugh about it at the end of the line because it's nothing like what you started with. And critics of the Bible will say, that's what you've got here. You don't have any of the originals. You don't have any way to check it. And so it has been passed down through all this time until it's just morphed and changed, and you don't know what the original text is. Well, nothing could be further from the truth. First of all, that game is designed to be confusing. You only get to say it once. You have to whisper it only to one person. They have to immediately turn and whisper to somebody else. It's designed to mess you up. Transmitting the Bible is nothing of the sort. These people took their jobs seriously. There are some articles I can recommend. One is called In Praise of the Ancient Scribes. I don't know the author, but he goes into detail about the care, the training these scribes took. Some of the scribes took their job so seriously and took God so seriously that they would actually, whenever they came across the name of God, Yahweh, in the Bible, they would stop, change pens, they would go essentially be baptized in a mikveh right there by the scriptorium and come back to write that name. They took it very seriously. If they messed up anything, they would start over. They would scratch it all over. They did such good work that often when scholars feel they've caught them in some kind of an error, later research shows that the scribe was correct. So, for copying of short notes, they would stand, but for big texts of the Bible, they would sit. And these are images I just took in Greece of some Egyptian scribes. So you can kind of see the position that he's in, and he's got his work out here. And keep in mind, they didn't have any copy machines, they didn't have email. They have a Gutenberg press. So everything that got printed got handwritten. So you would be in a scriptorium and you would have a lead scribe who would read the text, and it was his job. He was trained to read it. And there were several writers who were making copies of it. And they would very carefully do that in a very prescribed manner. So many characters per line, so that they could go back and check these things. They were very, very serious about it. And we see some of the tools of the trade. This is an inkwell found at Qumran, where the Dead Sea Scrolls were found. Reed pens with some of the ink still on them there. Those are some of the things that they would use. And there was quality control. So you would have the inspector who would come in and he would check your work. And like I said, they would have middle points, and they did all sorts of things to make quality control. They knew the midpoints of the book, midpoints of the page. They would count the number of letters and make sure that you had them correct. It's incredible when you come to religious work, the Bible, how careful they were at checking all of that. Oftentimes, scribes would even include in the margins some notes, some things complaining sometimes about how hard their work was. I can relate sometimes, only at PTP. But he says, sad it is, that little variegated white book, a day will come in truth when someone over thy page will say, the hand that wrote it is no more. That was an Irish scribe that wrote at the end of his long work. There were a couple others that are interesting. One of them said, finally, I'm done with this. Things like that, you can see how hard and laborious it would be under those conditions. There's another book I can recommend just as a general history. It's not really religious, but it's called How the Irish Saved Civilization. It talks about kind of how after the fall of the Roman Empire, the Irish monks that were not affected by that kept copying manuscripts and eventually transferred them into Europe. And it helped save all of those works that we currently have. So in Judaism, scribes had a special place of honor. Sometimes they get a little bit puffed up about it. You see Jesus talking to them sometimes not too nicely. But they had all this respect, oftentimes a lot of money. And it's because they knew the law so well, and because they copied it, and they were specially trained. So they had education, they had money, and they had power. So we see the kind of position that they were in. And they took God's name so seriously and God's word so seriously that there really is very little doubt that the Old Testament has been copied professionally for hundreds and hundreds of years. But everybody makes errors, and there are two types. There are unintentional errors, and then there are intentional errors. So what do we mean by unintentional errors? Well, I think we all have made those. I made an unintentional error by wearing this coat today. But because of the abundance of manuscripts, and we're going to talk about the manuscripts here in a minute, the abundance of manuscripts of the New Testament, there are an abundance of unintentional errors and variant readings. And by some estimates, there are as many as 400,000 unintentional errors. So that number seems staggering. You say, 400,000 errors? How could you believe anything that the Bible said? Well, that would be true if we didn't have thousands of manuscripts, and I'm counting everything as an error, from a misspelled word to a skipped letter. These generate nonsense readings, particularly in Greek, where you have, you know, the base and the word endings that tell you the tense. It's really easy to see where words begin and end. It's really easy, typically, to see where a word has been misspelled or a letter has been skipped. It's not hard to figure it out, and we have multiple copies to go off of, and we can easily see where these unintentional errors were made. It's not a big deal at all. It's really easy. Those are the easy ones. Intentional errors are a little bit more difficult. These are corrections in spelling, euphemisms that they will change to more modern euphemisms, grammatical form, sometimes letter forms can change over time. And these are abundant, sometimes spelling and proper names changes. These are things that typically don't affect doctrine, and they're easy to spot. They also help us date different manuscripts. We'll talk about that in just a moment as well. And they're easy to find when they were introduced because, again, we have such an abundance of manuscripts. We can see in the earlier manuscripts these things didn't exist and they got changed as time changed. But sometimes they do show a lack of faith and understanding. This is particularly true in the New Testament and in the Gospel accounts where more modern, I'm talking like 400s, 500s, 600s, people would try to harmonize the Gospel accounts. You know, sometimes the Gospel accounts talk about the same event or have the same general speech of Jesus, and they don't match exactly because they're coming from different witness accounts, but also because a variety of other reasons. If Jesus was speaking in Aramaic or in Hebrew to an audience, and then they are translating it to the Greek, that accounts for some differences. Also, I know some of you are preachers, right? So do you just preach a sermon one time, or sometimes you write a sermon and then you go somewhere else and you preach that sermon and then use that same sermon somewhere else? Maybe it's just me. But Jesus did that for sure. He went around, he's not rewriting sermons, he's preaching the same sermons in a variety of locations, and that also accounts for some of the differences. And if every single account matched exactly, that would be suspicious. If you and I went to a ball game and we went to somebody and reported it and we both said exactly the same thing, that would be a little suspicious. I might talk about, if it's baseball, I might talk about the wonderful pitching. You might talk about the home run in the eighth inning. It would be a different account, but it would be the same game and they would both be accurate. So things that are perceived as contradictions or errors always have explanations. Again, I recommend The Anvil Rings by Eric Lyons. I think that's a wonderful, wonderful book. All right. We go into the manuscripts. I do want to say to, let me see, on rare occasions, doctrinal changes are introduced. And that's extremely rare and it's pretty easy to see when they happen. They're called interpolations. I think it's extremely rare. I think we can talk about it after if you'd like. I don't want to go way into interpolations, but I think there are only two definite instances of it. Manuscripts. As we start to look at manuscripts, I want to observe a few things about scrolls. You have a picture of the scroll up there, but here it is, right? And it's kind of like songbooks. Now, turn to Leviticus 12. It's going to be a little bit tricky to do, but I'm eventually going to get there, right? And as you can see, that kind of, you're putting a lot of strain on the seams, and then you've got to roll this back up, and it's not a great way to read, to carry around, etc. Scrolls have limitations. They're big, they're bulky, they're difficult to use, they wear out with use much faster than books, and they're hard to conceal. And I feel like there's decent evidence. I'm a librarian and I've studied the history of books, and it's extremely boring, and I won't go into all of that for you. I find it interesting. I have a book that's just about bookshelves. So that's the history of bookshelves. So you can imagine what my bedstand reading is like. There's decent evidence to show that really Christians, at least if they didn't invent the book, they improved the book and they used the book more than anyone else in the late 1st, 2nd, 3rd, 4th centuries until it becomes just the standard. And for the New Testament, they start making copies and making translations almost immediately. which is great because it means we have tons and tons of manuscripts. And they typically kept them in four different sets. It would be the four gospel accounts. Let's see if I put a slide. Probably did. Yep, four gospel accounts, Acts and the general epistles, the Pauline epistles, including Hebrews. Not getting into that. And then the book of Revelation. And these were typically four different books that they would keep. And that's, you can see even in early printing how bulky things get. That's why they would keep those small and easy to conceal, particularly as you get into the late second, third, fourth centuries as persecution becomes greater. This is true again later in persecution in England, especially. Parts of Europe where you could be executed for having a Bible in your language by the Catholic Church, then later by the Lutheran Church. We did not get this book easily. You know, we take it for granted so often. So again, we don't have any autographs, but we know what they would have looked like. There are some examples of papyrus pages. You can see there, we talked about papyrus in the previous class, but they would have these pages like this. This is almost certainly what the New Testament was written on. And they would bind these. And in dry conditions, particularly in Egypt, we find a lot of these kinds of works. And that's wonderful. This is possibly the earliest Christian letter, but it's not for sure. Some scholars think it is, a lot of scholars think it isn't, but it refers to philia, which is brotherly love. It doesn't refer to anything else of a Christian nature. But this is what first and second century letters would have looked like. When you got the book of Philippians, and you're like, I've got a letter from Paul, and we're going to read it. This is what they would have been reading. And we talk about paleography. This is a way to tell how old manuscripts are. So I always try to give you examples that we can kind of relate to. One of them is English, for instance. You'll take a look at these King James pages. They're a little bit difficult to read. If you look at some of the earlier ones, like the Tyndale, and even earlier that are up here, the Geneva Bibles, and I think there's a couple that are even earlier. You can tell how hard they are to read. They're in English, but it's not our English. It's not even our King James English in that 1611. So it's very difficult sometimes to read, but it is a way for us to date things. So you look at, for instance, this is an old English reading. So that's in English. Can you read it? I can't read it. But that's old English. You might be able to pick out a word here and there. I don't know, to hun. He's evidently writing to his wife, I don't know. But you might be able to pick out a word, but old English is difficult, but we can tell what period that's from the letter forms and from the words that are being used and the spelling. And then you look at Middle English. It's not a lot better for me, still pretty difficult. But there's different letter forms, there's different words that are used. You can tell when in the English history that is written. And we see different letter forms that are happening that have like this A and E that are together, that's Oz and Cat, and these others that are give you different pronunciations. In the King James, you'll notice that F's are S's. It's things like that that help us with the Greek date the manuscripts. Greek also changed in this way. It's not a Greek class. I'm just telling you this is how they date the different manuscripts. I want to talk about the number of manuscripts, and I want to go into this a little bit in detail because I think it's so important. I've talked in, I think, three of my seven classes this week about this point, that the Bible is such superior history than all of the ancient historians. But if you had to pick an ancient history that's also religious in nature, you would go with Homer and the Iliad and the Odyssey. These were sacred works to them. They are poetical, and they tell the story of Odysseus and his journeys, oftentimes with gods and goddesses. No classicist would say these are real history, but there is real history sprinkled in there. And no, nobody really debates the text of the Odyssey or the Iliad. This is the best attested text in ancient history besides the Bible. It was written about 900 BC. The earliest fragment that we have is 400 BC, 500 years after it was written. And the number of copies, we have about 643 different manuscripts of it that give us what we know of the Iliad and the Odyssey. Other things have much, much less manuscript evidence. Aristotle, for instance, again, we are missing parts of Aristotle that we don't have. They know that we know they existed. We're missing parts of Shakespeare, by the way. If you happen to find one, as somebody recently did, you'll get rich. But Aristotle, he wrote between 384 and 322 BC. The earliest manuscript we have is 1100 AD, 1400 years after it was written. There are only 49 manuscripts of it. So just think about that. Nobody says that we don't have the real words of Aristotle. Julius Caesar, he wrote his biography just before he got stabbed. And he lived between 144 BC. The earliest manuscript we have is on the screen. It's 900 AD, 1,000 years almost after it was written. The number of manuscripts we have of it are 10. For Plato, again, one of the most studied in history. Plato, Socrates, he wrote Socrates' teachings, and he also wrote some of his own teachings, wrote several books. The earliest copy we have, he wrote in the 300s BC, and 900 AD, 1200 years, one fragment from the 3rd century BC. So there's one fragment, it's here, of Plato. Everything else is much later, and we have 7 copies. And then Pliny, he wrote from 61 to 113 AD. There's some very famous letters that he wrote to Trajan about Christians and what he should do with them. That's all the letters are about. Justin Rogers is actually going to teach a class on it in Sevierville, so if you're going to Sevierville, you should go. I'm really looking forward to that class. The earliest copy we have is from 850 AD, 750 years later, and there are again 7 copies available. So what about the New Testament? 5,800 Greek manuscripts of the New Testament, plus. And a few of them are purported to be first century fragments, but definitely some second century fragments, 3rd century, 4th century, much closer, much, much better than any of the other ancient manuscripts. And that only is counting Greek. They immediately started translating it into other languages, Latin, Syriac, Ethiopic, many others. There are 10,000, can I put that up there? Nope. There are 10,000 Latin manuscripts. This is the Bible manuscripts compared to everybody else. So, as you can see, the Bible wins. God wins. God's able to protect his masterpiece. Over 10,000 Latin manuscripts, 9,300 in some of these other languages. Many of these are early. They're not as studied as Greek, because there are a lot more Greek scholars than there are Ethiopic scholars. But they are studied, and they are impressive. Also, if we didn't have all of these manuscripts and all of this evidence, and we couldn't tell when all of them were written, like we can, from paleography, like I talked about, if we didn't have any of that, if somehow all of those got destroyed, if Diocletian was successful in destroying in the 3rd century all the manuscripts of the Bible, like he claimed to have done, he didn't do too well, but what they so-called early church fathers, early writings of the Christian church, some starting at the end of the 1st century, going into the 2nd century and beyond, they quoted scripture all the time Have any of you read Eusebius, Origen, those guys? Those guys write like they're just quoting scripture. It's really neat. I don't know if you've ever heard a sermon. I've heard a couple that are just scripture. Like they're structured in such a way that the preacher gets up and he just quotes scripture, but in the form of a sermon. It's really neat to do that. That's how these guys wrote. And over 99% of the New Testament could be reconstructed just from the early church fathers, so-called fathers. If we didn't have any manuscripts of the New Testament. I mean, it's remarkable. I got in an argument with a librarian one time who told me that he just thought all of the New Testament was written later, probably 3rd, 4th century. And I was like, there's zero chance that that's true. There's just zero. There's just overwhelming evidence that that's not true. He just didn't want to believe it because he would have had to change his life if he believed in the New Testament. If you compare this to any other works in ancient literature, even the top works, some of which I went through, there's just no comparison. The New Testament has about 20,000 lines, while the Iliad has about 15,000. So only 40 lines, 40 out of 20,000 are in doubt at all. And 764 lines of the Iliad are in question, about 5% of it. The earliest manuscript of the Iliad, like I said, is at least 500 years removed from the autograph. So the New Testament not only survived in more manuscripts than any other book from antiquity, but it has survived in a much purer form. And we continue to find manuscripts. You've probably heard of the so-called Green Collection. Maybe you've been to the Bible Museum in Washington, D.C. This is the Hobby Lobby founder who started collecting things, sometimes unscrupulously. And he had to return twice now. He's had to return thousands of artifacts and manuscripts that were looted or were bought from people who looted in Iran and Iraq and other places. But he's made it his mission to try to find other early manuscripts, to uncover them. And we are finding new manuscripts, and sometimes very early ones. There's been a couple, one piece of James, for instance, that has been found that's purported to be first century. Some of that is in doubt now because they won't release all the scholarship on it. They won't release everything that we would like to see from it. But there are manuscripts that are being found. And there are some exciting things happening in this realm. I just want to share a couple of them with you. One of them is called cartonnage. This is the wrappings of mummies. I don't know if any of you have ever seen an old book, maybe from the 1800s, and the binding might be coming off, and what you see under there is like newspaper or other binding material. They need to have some kind of filler, so that they'll use other books or newspapers or other things to use in the binding material to glue the backing, this part, onto the book to form the binding. Mummy wrappings also did that. They took papyrus scrolls that weren't being used or that had worn out, and they used those to wrap the mummies. Now, right now, if you want to find out what was on those things, you have to destroy the mummy. You have to take it apart. It's a little controversial. It has happened. They have found some interesting things, including some poetry from people that they knew about, but they didn't have any poetry from them. It's a very exciting time. This fragment, for instance, is found. You're not going to find whole books, but you will find fragments of things. It's a very interesting field of study, and I'm hopeful that they will be able to eventually do it in a non-destructive way. And I think they probably should stop until they do that. As they did with the Herculaneum scrolls. I was just in Herculaneum, and they didn't let me get anywhere near this, by the way. But these are scrolls that were charred in the eruption of Mount Vesuvius in 79 AD. Now, that's very exciting. They found an entire library encased in Herculaneum, and it's different than in Pompeii. In Pompeii, the ash very slowly settled. So you have these cavities with the bodies and things like that you may have seen, where they fill that in with plaster, and you can see what the body, the person, looked like as they died. It's a very moving experience. But at Herculaneum, it was different. There, mud came in and filled all that in very quickly. So you have no bodies, anything like that. They did find some bones down in a place where they all kind of ran to the sea and tried to get away. But whole villas, whole shops, whole stores were just instantly filled with volcanic mud, hot volcanic mud. And it burned up these scrolls. But then when they removed all the mud, they had this entire library of these scrolls. It's very, very exciting. But they couldn't do anything with them. They found them in the 1700s. They tried several methods of peeling them apart. They destroyed a few of them to do that, and they decided we need to stop, and maybe one day the technology will come where they will be able to figure out how to do this without destroying them. So they saved them, and that's wonderful that they did, because that day has come. Just recently, they did the first one, this one. They had no idea what was in it, but using scanners and AI technology, they were able to figure out what it was. It was Plato, some information about Plato, including they figured out where his burial site was. You may have seen it on the news. So in the first scroll, that's already revealed knowledge. Over the coming years, there's no telling what was in that library in 79 AD. There may be New Testament manuscripts in there. It's very, very exciting. I can't wait to see what else is revealed. It could be the greatest find since the Dead Sea Scrolls, which would be very, very exciting. So watch that, watch news. If you hear anything, sometimes you hear things on the news and they are not real discoveries of a biblical significant nature. This one is. If you hear something about the Herculaneum Scrolls, that will be very exciting. I'm running out of time, of course, but I want to say a couple of things here. You've got uncials and then cursives or minuscules. That's the two types of manuscripts. And with uncials, what you're dealing with are all capital letters with no spaces, certain number of letters per line, and they look very strange to our eyes to try to read this. This is in English, of course, but I put it on there. But can you make it out what it says?
Yeah,
right? You can. Without too much difficulty. Critics will say, oh, you can't, that's confusing, it's gonna lead to all kinds of variant readings. There's no way you can sort all that out. But I guess, again, they didn't take Greek and they don't understand word endings. It's not that hard to figure it out. They'll say, did you ever see abundance on the table? Which they'll say is, did you ever see a bun dance on the table? But I think it's pretty easy to figure out that it leads to nonsense readings if you try to do that. The most important and earliest manuscripts are uncials, and you have Codex Sinaiticus up there. That is one of the three great uncials. And what you'll see is, and this is said, let's see, Romans 16, around 21, 22, in Galatians, at the end, 6:11, something like that, you'll see there was a scribe, there was a person that was helping Paul copy that letter. And that's what you have here. You have professional people who are making these copies, and you have three great uncials. You have the Vaticanus, or Vatican. Guess where they keep that? The Vatican. They don't keep it on display, but they keep it there. The Sinaiticus. Guess where they found that? Mount Sinai. See, it's not a trick question. And then at St. Catherine's Monastery and at the foot of Mount Sinai. And the Alexandrian or Alexandrian, I can't say it. Alexandrian, it's whatever. I'm not Latin, guys. It's not my thing. And so you can see these three great manuscripts. These are early. Hey. I was right, Romans 16 and Galatians 6. And they're up here, and they're referred to as A, B, and Aleph, or 1, 2, and 3. They're the most famous of the uncials. They're almost complete copies of the gospel, and I just don't have time to get into all of that. I'll have to do it next year when you all come back to PTP. All right, so we'll stop there. And if you'd like to, you can come up here if you didn't get a chance earlier and take a look at some of the manuscripts that I brought up here. But obviously, they don't all fit with what I've covered so far. So, thank you.